Welcome to the Analytics Power Hour. Analytics topics covered conversationally and sometimes with explicit language. Here are your hosts, Mo, Michael, and Tim.
Hi, everyone. It's the Analytics Power Hour, episode 176, and I want to introduce you to my co-hosts, Mo Kiss. You lead marketing analytics at Canva, and how are you doing?
I'm fantastic.
Outstanding. Tim Wilson, you're the senior director of analytics at Search Discovery. What does that mean in your day-to-day life?
That means I'm wondering how much caffeine you had right before we started recording.
None at all.
Okay.
I'm just projecting a lot of energy because I'm super excited about our show, and I'm Michael Helbling. Let's get started. You know, you do know that feeling, you know, just rocketing to about 150 miles an hour in a couple seconds as the catapult throws you and your aircraft off a ship into a mixture of sea and sky. And if everything goes smoothly, you get all sky. Oh, you don't know that feeling. Well, you know, we've all seen it on TV and in movies. And sure, the pilot's job is pretty cool. And we're all analysts, and we see all those other people in all the different color outfits doing their jobs, sort of creating this crazy orchestra of activity, leading to this amazing capability of putting jets in the air from almost anywhere in the world. And it's interesting because from the earliest sailors, data was used to navigate, first with the stars, and, well, it's gotten a bit more sophisticated since then. But we're going to use this show to take a few steps closer to understanding some of the modern uses of data at sea. And for that, we definitely needed a qualified guest, and we got one. Captain Paul Lanzalotta is the commanding officer of the USS Gerald R. Ford. He's logged over 2,600 hours in 22 different types of aircraft, including the E-2C Hawkeye. He's a graduate of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and was commissioned through the Naval ROTC program. He also has earned a master's degree from Johns Hopkins University and has served in numerous assignments both at sea and on shore. He's been awarded numerous decorations throughout his career, and today he is our guest. Welcome aboard the USS Analytics Power Hour, Captain Lanzalotta.
All right. Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Okay. So the one thing we haven't actually done is how are we supposed to address you? Because you're a captain, but can we call you just...
I prefer Lord... No, I'm just kidding.
Lord Admiral Lanzalotta.
No, I think Paul is fine, or Paul. Or whatever works for you.
Yeah. What do the guys and girls on the ship call you? CO or...
Well...
I think they call him Sir.
Oh, sir.
That's a really good question. Yeah. Generally, sir is an easy one. And on Fridays, we go with first name Friday. So only my direct reports, and we kind of play a little flattening of the power gradient there game. And we'll go first name Friday, and I'll get a lot of Paul that day.
So, that's cool.
Otherwise, it's generally sir or skipper or boss or whatever.
Wow. Casual Fridays, even the Navy. I love it.
No, it's not casual at all. It's first name Friday.
Yeah. Well, no. Wait, first name. That's the Navy version of casual Fridays. This small group of people can use my first. Anyways, well, it's an honor. And thanks so much for coming on the show. And we're delighted to have you. I think just to get us started, I think very few of us understand, and lots of us, our listeners, understand really the scope and scale of the ship that you're commanding. And I think just to get us started, it'd just be good to sort of put some shape around that.
Sure. Yeah, it's a pretty big ship. If you've seen it at sea or if you've seen pictures, it probably jumps out in that regard, although there are plenty of aircraft carriers that look about the same shape but are a bit smaller. So just in terms of general dimensions, and forgive me, I don't have the metric available, but 1,100 feet long. So
we're hoping for displacement, just kidding.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because it's important to realize, you know, the differences there, because not all the attributes of a ship scale with length. So the ship is 1,100 feet long and would draft about 40 feet, depending on the loading, how many aircraft, what kind of weapons are on board, and that sort of thing, how much fuel. And by that I mean jet fuel. So that's the length of the ship, and the ship displaces about 90 to 100,000 tons. And that's the pretty common reference point for maritime measurements. But if you go back to my last ship that I commanded, was an LPD or landing transport dock, That ship was about 700 feet long, just shy of 700 feet, but it only displaced 25,000 tons. So, you know, about three quarters the length, but fully one quarter of the displacement. And then if you look at a destroyer, a U.S. Navy destroyer, which are among the biggest destroyers in the world, if you just compare them nation to nation, those ships are about 500 feet long and they displace about 7,000 tons, just, you know, less than a tenth of the displacement of an aircraft carrier, but about half of the length. So that kind of just, you know, it doesn't scale linearly with displacement, and displacement matters because that's where all the people and all the things go. Machinery that
as a Navy noob, when you say displacement, do you mean weight? Is it like what you're carrying or what the total load of the ship is?
Yeah, so it's essentially the weight. So it's that whole Archimedes principle thing. So if you were to take the volume of the water that the ship pushes out of the way, that how much does that volume actually weigh? And that's what that number means.
Oh, it's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a shit ton.
It's funny because I was looking at when I was young, I was able to go to Charleston, South Carolina. They have the USS Yorktown there, mm-hmm. Which is, I believe, like a World War II era aircraft carrier.
Yes.
And it's maybe served in Vietnam too, but or Korean. But just from the pictures, I was like, oh, this is a much smaller vessel than the Gerald R. Ford. Like much smaller. And they're both aircraft carriers. So I was like, okay, yeah, this is a big one.
Yeah, so back in the earlier wars, in World War II, we had scores of aircraft carriers. We didn't have just, right now we've got 11, depending on how you count them, you know, the ones that are, there's one that's being built right now, USS John F. Kennedy, or PCU John F. Kennedy, Pre-Commissioning Unit John F. Kennedy. So back in those days, we needed a lot more of these ships to do similar kinds of missions, and the reach of the ships weren't nearly as extensive. They were powered with diesel fuel, not with nuclear power the way we do now, so that their endurance was a whole different story. They had a whole different footprint in terms of how much logistic support was required and how long they could go without resupply, which is a pretty big deal for us. So that's one of the reasons why the ship is larger than they used to be. And then there's just a matter of how much striking power can we carry. So how many aircraft, how big are those aircraft, how far can those aircraft fly, and how many weapons can they carry? And those are all really important things when you compare these kinds of capabilities.
So can you say, like, ballpark how many people, like, if you were deployed on a lengthy deployment, kind of how many, like, people are on the ship?
Sure. Yeah, so the ship's crew, my ship's crew, just the crew that run the ship and run the flight deck and do all the things, is about 2,700 people. And then we embark almost 2,000 more people in terms of what the air wing brings. So the aircraft that fly onto the ship are all commanded by individual commanding officers, which was the first command that I had about 11 years ago. And so we embark that whole air wing. We embark the command and control that makes sure that air wing can be sustained and be, you know, do all the planning that's required to do their missions. And then we also embark a staff for the admiral that embarks in the ship. That staff is about 70 people. And then we'll embark a commodore who's in charge of all the destroyers in the strike group, and we'll bring his staff along with us, another 40 or 50 people. So it adds up to about 4,700 people on my ship. On the older carriers, we needed more people. So the crew on a Nimitz-class carrier is about 3,200. And then you'd end up with about a little over 5,000, about 5,100 or 5,200 people on the ship when deployed and you know, over the horizon.
And that's due to technology and automation? I mean, is that more coverage can be done with fewer people? Okay.
Short answer is yes. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So, yeah, so you'll probably, you know, if you go down a Google wormhole down into the, you know, figuring out things about new ships and stuff, you'll see that our ship has a lot more electric and electronic systems on it that used to be more conventionally powered. So the way we launch aircraft, for example, is done with electromagnetic fields and forces as opposed to using old-fashioned steam. So when you use old-fashioned steam, it comes with it all the maintenance that's required for those giant steam risers, all the giant valves that go along with the giant steam riser valves. And we're still I think in the process of maturing our awareness of what our actual efficiencies are in the long run, which, you know, that's the whole idea of bringing fewer people to see, is the people component is actually the most expensive component of what we do because of how we take care of our folks.
And so how do you, I mean, is that something that, like, you or the team are responsible for measuring and reporting back on? Like, is that a measure that the Navy is trying to, like, track and improve over time? And if so, how do you do that?
So for my team, it's mostly more rudimentary costs and not the life cycle costs that come along with the ship. There's a whole part of the Navy that does program management and the acquisition of ships and systems that are put on ships. And they're a whole lot more interested in the cradle to grave costs and things. And, you know, there's a model that they're going by that they're using up front. And then as we progress down the maturation of the system of systems, they'll add the data that, you know, either validates the model or makes the model learn, so that they can more accurately assess what those costs are and whether or not we're as efficient as we want to be.
So what are the more tactical, so is your, I guess the scope of your responsibility for, I mean, is it really like, it's like basically half of the people on the boat are kind of
ship,
under you,
not mine.
And there's a, oh, ship, yeah.
Ooh, yeah, boy. So that's good. I'm glad you did that, Mo, because I didn't have to. No, I'm just kidding. The traditional would say a ship has boats, which we do. So if you can carry a boat on the boat, then you're a ship. But I think, you know, and the more stodgy among us would say, well, please call it a ship, not a boat. But the 100% truth is that a lot of people on my ship call it a boat.
As I was doing, like, research and prepping, I was trying really hard. I knew that I was doing the ship thing, and I kept finding myself. So, of course, comes through in the, I screwed up in the.
I think what Paul's trying to say is, you could serve on the ship, you probably just couldn't command it.
I probably couldn't call on Paul. I wouldn't be able to call on Paul on Fridays, I don't think.
You might not be that select group.
I might be one of the first staff decommissioned.
Your question was about, like, you know, what things are we measuring, or what things are we from a data analytics perspective, like what do I get into with respect to that?
Yeah. I mean, I guess, like, if we started with kind of like what are you actually responsible for, and then where do you then spend your time thinking? Because I guess you said it was kind of the more tech, you're not worrying about the overall life cycle of the boat, you're kind of, it sounds like, on a little bit of a shorter horizon. So what are you what are you responsible for? And then how do you actually monitor what's working or what's not, or what you need to adjust?
Yeah, that's a good, there's a lot in there. So I'll try to start with, yeah. So the short answer to what I'm responsible for is everything, all of it, you name it. That's the nature of being a ship's captain is, you know, whether it's the perception of what the ship does and is and what our culture is, all the way down to the more, you know, granular details of, like, well, you know, what are we doing today? What maintenance items are we performing? And so the example I would give that I do pay a lot of attention to on a routine basis is the planned maintenance that we do on the ship and the most of the components in the ship, to make sure that it's, so all those things need to function properly, and it all ties down to what a sailor has to do on a day-to-day basis as she walks the deck plates and does her job. So that gets aggregated in a kind of a I would call it an access database on steroids. It's an app or an application that we have contracted and bought that tracks all of the planned maintenance and all of the, you know, preventative maintenance that we're doing. And that's everything from the, you know, the anchors that are on the front of the ship. I need to know that they're going to work. I need to know that the brakes work. I need to know that the windlass that brings the anchor in is going to work, all the way down to, like, the trash disposal or the ovens that are in the galleys that where we feed people, or the commodes, the toilets that we use every day. All that stuff needs to be maintained properly. And it aggregates to about 100,000 maintenance efforts every quarter.
Wow. So, and is that those maintenance efforts, are they something that you do Like, is that kind of an always on thing, even when you're at sea, or is that something that you only do when you're not in a deployment?
Yeah, it's always on.
Wow.
Always on. If you put this giant ship into a bathtub of salt water, you know, if you take your most prized possession and put it in that environment, you can probably think about like, oh, wow, I'm going to have to do a lot of things just to keep this thing running.
So is that, if you've got 100,000 things and they're all supposed to be, this is supposed to be daily, this is supposed to be weekly, this is supposed to be monthly, is that kind of, there's an access database on steroids saying these need to be done. When somebody does one, they log that it's been done, and that's then what you're looking at is saying, do we have areas where the maintenance that was scheduled hasn't been done, or we have a whole group of areas, which means it wasn't done or it wasn't recorded, or is it this thing actually isn't working? The anchor, there's a signal, or are those two different things? One that we're doing what we think we needed to do as planned, and we have issues there, but are there separate, is there a totally separate way of saying this broke, this door won't shut, you know, or maintenance tickets?
Yeah, there are separate efforts for corrective maintenance. And then I also get reports from each, so there are 20 departments on the ship. They all own their spaces and they own all the maintenance of all the things inside those spaces in the ship. And they individually keep track of all of their gear and whether or not it's like fully up or up with some degrading kind of factors or out of commission, doesn't work. If it's in the out of commission, doesn't work category, then we use a whole separate process to program maintenance for it. And it's, sometimes it's just a sailor fixing a door, which can be fairly complicated, or it's a much bigger job that we have to screen to a dedicated maintenance period, if that makes sense.
So do you run into do you run into data collection issues where there's a group that's good at, they're doing the stuff, but they're forgetting, or it's not getting, I'm assuming, but a lot of the logging is not like going into the bathroom where somebody, you know, writes on a notepad that it's all digital. No,
it's walking into the head and writing on a notepad, but you're pretty darn close there. Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm just doing,
it's okay.
I was equating it to the land. I was equating it to like the airport restroom. No, I was, that's what I was
but
thinking.
I do love that Paul has picked up that a big part of this show is giving Tim shit. So, you know, you fit right in.
He's like,
well,
oh,
it's going to come
changed.
The other way. There's no doubt in my mind. We go back.
So the other, you kind of set this up a little earlier, the I won't even try. What do you call the catapult that you were describing that was
the electromagnetic aircraft launch system, the EMALS?
Yeah, maybe I don't feel too bad about that. That's a video I feel like I've now watched like 15 times, was the test where there's just kind of the dolly getting shot off into the water.
Oh, yeah, it's much more fun with actual aircraft.
Well... especially if somebody was in that.
It's much more fun being in the aircraft as well. I can attest to that. That's one of the cool parts of my job, is I get to strap in the aircraft and go flying, which is kind of a surreal experience.
Really?
To,
still?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh.
Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty surreal to take a catapult launch from your ship that you're still responsible for after you're, you know, circling overhead.
Talk about the people knowing when the boss is like not around.
Yeah,
like it's pretty.
Yeah,
visible.
Well, they ring a bell and they ring me off. They say, "Gerald R. Ford departing." Ding, and then the whole ship knows I'm not on the ship, including my boss, who's often on the ship as well. So that flag officer is the person that you know I work for and who writes my evaluation at the end of the experience. So that's good. It's really good. It's really humbling, which is the way I like it.
Okay, so. In addition to these, the maintenance work, what are the, I guess, the metrics that are, like, what are the things that are thrown around that are, like, in your head? Like, as an analyst, say, for example, I work in marketing, so it's always like, I know that this team has spent this much. I know that this is, like, the return on investment for this. Like, you know how there's just, like, stuff that you know, and every day you're like, is that on track or is that off track? Like, what are the things in your head every day, like the numbers that I guess you need to know everything's on track? Or is there like that the ship's going in the right direction? And yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. it's a blend of subjective as well as objective or numbers measures. So that's kind of why there's a human side of this enterprise, because I can walk around the ship and within 20 or 30 minutes really get a sense for, like, are things okay right now? Are we on track or what? Like, I need to talk to sailors. I need to see in their eyes and see. I need to, you know, get a sense for the crew has a spirit, and it's palpable when you walk through. You can tell. So when we went to our shock trials, which I'm sure we'll talk about, you can feel that the excitement, and you could feel also the anxiety of the unknown before we did the first event. So there's a subjective part of it, which is, hey, are things on track? Like, is there a huge line waiting for lunch, or are the sailors all kind of going through the line and you know, at least somewhat happy about the prospects of the food that's coming to them? So that's one. It's a small thing, but it's a pretty big deal to me that my crew is happy and that they're able to eat, because you're not going to do a great job and you're not going to fight the ship real well if you're pissed off and hungry. So that's just kind of a subjective thing. Some of the other stuff that I would say is, are we on schedule? Are we executing the thing that we said we were going to do yesterday when I signed the flight schedule? When the clock, you know, if our first aircraft is supposed to be off the front of the ship at 11 o'clock in the morning, I want to see the seconds going towards 11, and I want to see that aircraft literally leaving the ship at 1100 and not 1115 seconds, because that tells me, well, we weren't really all on the same page. We didn't get the memo, you know, all the way down to the sailor. The sailor that's pressing that button could be maybe just 2 years in the Navy, third class petty officer, you know, E4, at one of a pretty advanced qualification, but pretty junior in the grand scheme of things. But that person all the way down at his or her level needs to understand, like, hey, we're doing this on time. Because, and the real point of that is, I don't want to be in a position to have where I'm flying aircraft. I need to be in the wind typically, which means I'm not maneuvering the ship maybe in the direction that I'm choosing, because the wind chooses its own direction. And so the longer we're doing that, the more vulnerable we can be. So that's one of my metrics, is how fast are we launching and recovering aircraft? If I'm shooting 10 and recovering 13, how long did that take? And we use that as a metric when we're practicing.
Sorry, can you explain that? Shooting 10 and recovering 13. Like, shooting 10 aircraft off?
Yeah, so we carry around 60 or 70 aircraft on any given day. And on the flight deck, we'll have maybe, you know, on the order of 30 to 40, depending on what the day's missions hold. Are we doing a lot of searching, or are we doing a lot of repetitive strike on a target that's at sea, or are we trying to send aircraft a really far, long way downrange, like across land over to Afghanistan, loiter and wait to help troops that might be in a land battle, and then come all the way back? If that's what I'm doing, it's a different number of aircraft that I'm putting in the air. And the way U.S. Naval Aviation does that and has done that for decades is, we'll shoot waves of aircraft. So we will launch 10, 12, 15, 20 aircraft in a wave, and they'll go off and do their mission. And then we'll put the aircraft carrier where we want it in the time intervening, and then we will shoot another wave of aircraft, and that first wave will be on their way back or hanging out overhead, and they will recover. And then in the time that I'm resetting the position of the ship, we'll refuel those aircraft, we'll put a new set of crew in those aircraft, and we'll put new weapons on those aircraft, and then do the whole thing again. We'll shoot a whole other wave and recover the wave that was airborne in the intervening time. We call that cyclic flight operations.
Yeah. Wow. I'm like, we got so many questions.
Well, so right now, and I think we probably didn't, I'm sure anyone who wasn't already aware is already, you know, pulled over and Googled. So the stage that the Gerald R. Ford is in right now, it is still in a testing phase, right? What you're doing now is, we mentioned shock trials, I mentioned the dolly, you know, checking the, like, right now, is that a big part of what you're doing is that sort of testing and calibration? And is that the sort of thing that you have each day? These are the tests we're trying to do?
So we just finished up the majority of that. So we just finished our post-delivery testing and trials phase, and then right after that we went into our full ship shock trials phase, and we finished that, and we actually just moved the ship to the shipyard, to Newport News Shipbuilding, to do a round of modernization, some repair, some upgrade before we bring the ship back out to sea in the early spring next year and do all the things I'm talking about, really just operationally. So all the testing, most of the testing is behind us. We'll do some more testing to ensure that the modernization things that we're adding to the ship are working the way we expect them to. But for the most part, our testing phase is complete, which is really cool.
Is the testing was happening, and again, like the videos of the shock trials, which it might just be good to have you describe what those are, but where, how much is the, we did the, like there's, it seems like there's a responsibility. Did we do the tests that we were expecting? But then there's also, how did the tests, I imagine there's a million different things being checked during something like a shock trial. Is that like you're responsible for making sure the tests run, but then there's somebody back on shore who's analyzing the results of the test, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's a combination. So for most of these, we bring a team of civilian experts, both technicians as well as engineering type background folks, civilian team. And they are, many are on the ship observing firsthand what's happening with the system that they are the technical expert associated with. And then they've got reach back via the networks, you know, whether it's our unclassified network or even just a phone call back to their engineering organization where they can get more in-depth support. So it's actually a combination of my crew making sure that we're in the right initial conditions, making sure that we're taking the right precautions, making sure the environment is set up the way we plan for it to be, you know, the conditions that we plan for, and then executing the test in the right parameter set so that we can get the data we want and then analyze that data, some of it real time or some of it near real time. And then some of it, it'll be a, you know, a longer term analysis, you know, where we got to wait a week or two or even longer to actually aggregate all the information. So I'll give you two examples. One is the combat system ships qualification trial that we did in April, the final portion of that we did in April, where we basically shot all the weapons on the ship. We fired our self-defense weapons to include the close-in weapon system, which is a gun-based system, the rolling airframe missile, and the NATO Sea Sparrow missile against live targets. And so we had to do all the stuff I talked about earlier in order to do all those events. While we're doing them, the systems themselves will tell you, like, yeah, I, you know, either that went the way I wanted it to, which is actually how it all turned out, or, hey, we had an error in our, you know, our real-time built-in test that's built into the system, or during a pre-operational check, sometimes the system will say, you know what, I did not pass that, I need to do this check again, and then we'll run the check, we'll run that pre-operational check another time. So we'll see that real time. And then during the test itself, we'll execute it, and maybe somebody will observe, a human being will observe, hey, I didn't get this parameter that I wanted, let's do it again. And then there'll be reach back to the engineering enterprise that can see that all the, you know, all the data in detail to figure out, like, oh, we got what we needed or we didn't. And the idea for my ship is let's learn. So I don't see it as a proving effort, but an improving effort, because we're the first ship in the class. So we're expecting to find things that need to get better. And we want to find those things so that we can make the next three ships better.
So can you describe the shock trials? Because I have questions.
I'll do my best. So that one was planning, and more planning, I would say. A lot of planning, just first and foremost from the perspective of the environmental impact. We've got some information out there, you know, on social media that explains how we did all that. But, you know, we take that very, very seriously. Again, as the ship's captain, it's my name on this whole thing. You know, there are other people associated with the effort, and there are certainly people of a higher rank that were involved, but nobody's going to Google them and find them. They're going to find me if something went wrong. And I just owe it to my crew and to the people that embarked on the ship, their personal safety. So that, you know, whether it's the environmental impact, make sure we're taking the appropriate steps to avoid any kind of hazard to marine mammals, and that's not just injury. That's like we don't harass marine mammals. Some of the questions I've gotten from other friends of mine are like, "Oh, did you use like a sonar to scare away the mammals?" And that's a no-no. That's not what we do. We actually, position the ship where we know that we have a very, very, very low probability of seeing any of the species that we would be concerned about, which is pretty much any mammal out there. So that was one part of the plan. Another part of the plan is just risk mitigation from a standpoint of how do you safely explode a 40,000-pound live charge in the vicinity of your ship. And there's a safety piece for the people who have to deploy that. So that's a charge being towed behind another support vessel. And there are great Americans that are involved in the process of arming and lowering that charge at sea.
No pressure.
No small thing. Making sure that we're clear of any kind of weather hazards. So the weather had to be pretty nice for this. No thunderstorms, lightning, and explosives did not go well together. So that's something that we were really, really careful about.
Sorry, have I got it right?
Recording of it all.
So the purpose of the shock trials is to basically detonate explosives near the ship to see how it handles it? Is that the purpose?
It's pretty close. So like most test and evaluation, for what I've done anyway in the Navy, is it's to verify what we already know. So the ship was designed with an expectation of hardness against shock, against underwater explosion. The team that designed the ship used modeling and simulation to a really high level to build the ship, in addition to all the common engineering tools at hand for marine engineering and building a vessel like this. And then the way test and evaluation typically works is you have some measure of laboratory testing and then some measure of like not at sea testing. So for aircraft testing, that would be ground test. And then you have a small portion of the breadth and depth of that test that you do real time live end to end, so that you really know that all the systems as integrated in the ship behave the way you expect them to. So that it's really a verification of the shock hardening that we already know is engineered into the ship, more so than, hey, let's see what happens. So let's see what happens, in my mind, that equates to experimentation.
Hmm.
And we're not experimenting with this capital asset or the people inside it.
Hmm.
So it was more of a verification of what we expect.
But still, and especially let's go back to you as well as maybe somebody who is on the ship who's a couple of years in, like at the moment, everybody knows this is going to happen at some given point. With that, the human element of reading that, like surely, like is there like electricity in the air? I mean,
yeah,
like, absolutely. I mean, when it goes off, is it like the boat, like there's movement. It's not like, oh, right. I mean, that just seems like a movie type moment of like, okay,
yeah,
all the pre-work, we're just verifying, but we're verifying one time.
And I'm betting all of these people's well-being on it. You know, again, getting back to the sense of responsibility, it's not just my own well-being, but it's all the people in my ship, as well as the 300 or so civilians that embarked for it too. I think the oldest person we had with us was 79 years old, medically cleared, very, very well in shape, very sharp engineer, but she's got a few years on me. So, you know, I'm concerned that it was going to go. And as you would, as a human would, you know, always be very mindful of the things that are risky that we do. So I had plenty of sailors ask me like, "Hey, are you worried about this, Captain? You know, how do you feel? Are you scared?" And my answer, truthfully, is no, because if I had major concerns that would make me not want to do it, I would not have voted yes when we had our series of pre-briefs and pre-meetings all the way up the chain of command, all the way up to the Chief of Naval Operations, who received the information that I had in terms of how it was planned and what the risks really were. So there was definitely an excitement in the air, Tim. And there is definitely an electricity about the whole thing, because it's a kinetic event and it's a dynamic event. And we knew that, you know, especially after the first one, we knew that it would be loud. So sailors put in hearing protection, and turns out hearing protection works awesome. I strongly recommend it if you're going to be near something super loud to throw in some hearing protection, whether it's foamies or some other means of covering your ears. Overall, I think we had, by the end, we had a lot of confidence and a lot less anxiety because there's less unknown and more like, yeah, this is what's going to happen. This is what it's going to be like. There were a lot of people that were really excited and motivated by it to know, like, hey, this ship is strong. Like, look what just happened next to us. So that was pretty cool.
All right, let's step aside for a minute for a word about our sponsor, Observe Point. Do you know what Observe Point does, Tim?
Of course I do. Their tools give data professionals confidence in their data and insights.
Well, sure, but what is an insight really?
Really? Let's not go there.
Good call. Probably better to just provide a little more detail around the nuts and bolts of their platform. For instance, I bet you both know their tools can be used to automatically audit your whole website for data collection errors and on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, sure. But can they automatically audit sponsor messages in a podcast for flubs and miscues?
I wish, but I don't think so. To be honest, they're much more about digital data collection, testing your most important pages and user paths for functionality, and lastly, that it's accurately being collected.
And then what? Do you have to, like, remember to log in and check to see if it found any errors?
Ooh, no. But the platform will alert you immediately if something's going wrong. But you can track your data quality over time by logging into the tool, which, you know, who doesn't like to log in and check to see if you're on a steady march towards pristine data or a backwards slide towards some type of unreliable information, which...
We don't want that backwards slide.
No. In fact, you should slide on over to ObservePoint.com/AnalyticsPowerHour to learn more about ObservePoint's full data governance capabilities. Okay, let's get back to the show.
So, Tim, I'm going to totally turn this. I've been dying to do this the whole time to a topic, Paul, that you touched on, which I'm really passionate about, and so is Michael.
I think I know where you're going.
Okay, so I really am a big fan of Simon Sinek, and I've read his book, Leaders Eat Last, which talks a lot, actually, about military leadership and culture and a lot of things that any leader can really take away from the military. You've mentioned so many times about your people and the culture on the ship matters. Like, I'm really curious. I mean, you've got nearly 5,000 people at sea together. How do you manage, like, when there are those, you know, you can tell as a leader normally the vibe when things aren't going so well. Like, there's rumblings and, yeah, people are tired or grumpy and, like, you start to pick up, like, or they're overworked and they're not happy for some reason. But I can imagine it, like, oh, that's all heightened when you're at sea, right? Because you're, like, in each other's pocket. How do you address issues like that? Like, when how do you get the culture that you want to have on the ship?
So it has a lot to do with the leadership that's out on the deck plates, the leadership that, so I'm just one person. Of course, it's important for me to set the tone. So if when I talk to the crew, it's my job to be honest and transparent because anyone can tell when you're not telling them the truth. I mean, it's a human nature thing. So my first rule of thumb is be honest and transparent with the crew and not hold back things unnecessarily. It's very, very rare that I would shield something from the crew. And I get that as a feedback point quite a bit, but my sailors appreciate it. And they can tell when we're being open, and not every, I don't think every leader out there does that, whether in the Navy or not. I'm sure that you've seen that before where you can tell, like, hey, am I getting the whole story here? Like, what's the deal? So that's a good starting point from my perspective. But in order to keep positive culture on a warship, it really comes down, especially in the United States Navy, my experience is it comes down to the deck plate leaders. In our Navy, it's called the chief petty officers. So these are the senior enlisted leaders in my crew that have been at sea before, they've been in the Navy a while, they are above the frontline supervisor, so they're not quite like in the weeds of the everyday where the rubber meets the road in terms of like, who's got to do which job today? That's not their level. They're a level above that. And I meet with them pretty commonly and pretty routinely, whether informally at a meal or just in the passageway talking with them. But that group is a tremendously positive, encouraging, enthusiastic group on my ship, and I'm really lucky for that. I didn't get to, you know, choose all those people. I hopefully inspire and motivate them, but they're a really great group on Gerald R. Ford, and it's one of the reasons why I'm so, you know, thankful and lucky to be their skipper.
Okay, that was your touchy-feely crap moment, Mo. Back to the data.
Touchy-feely wins wars, man.
That's right. Haven't you ever seen Richard III, Tim?
This is why I have shirked the leadership responsibility for as much of my career as possible. But so I have like, and many like very, very small little questions. Like when it comes to, like, you mentioned like having an app, which the military commissioned and was built and is secure and does all that. Like, are there mainstream or people working in Excel? Are they doing PowerPoint stuff? Like,
Yes. Excel is pretty common. It's something that people are pretty familiar with, and it does enough rudimentary stuff that you can very quickly, but, you know, get some numbers down and look at what trends might be. As soon as I took command in February, and I'd been on the ship for about a month, and that was before we had access to vaccine for the majority of my crew. Only the healthcare providers had access to vaccine, which is about 4 or 5% of my crew. So I was really interested in our, like, what our COVID trends were looking like, and how they changed from when we were at sea to when we were in port, because we've got some very, very careful operational guidance in place for the safety of the crew and the assurance of the mission. So I just, you know, I pulled up an Excel spreadsheet and started putting daily numbers on there. And yes, I put I can figure out still to this day to how to make a trend line on Excel. So that's a dumb, stupid example, but that's an example of where I would use that, where people use trackers probably in Excel quite a bit. We do use relational databases for things like watch bills, so that you can make sure that you're putting people on watch who are actually qualified for the watch that you're assigning them to. And then, you know, there's a handful of other applications out there that are Navy sponsored and Navy programs of record that do some of this stuff. I try to avoid PowerPoint from a standpoint of running the machine, because PowerPoint will take as much time as you have to create said PowerPoint, but it's still part of how the military asks for, you know, consolidation of information for briefings that go up to higher headquarters and things like that. So we still use it.
I work at a company that has some great presentation software that might be able to help with that.
Yeah, great. Well, yeah. Get a military contract going. That's perfect.
Yeah.
So, do you have a sense for how much data the ship is producing, say, on a daily basis? Because I'm assuming all these different systems are logging things and keeping them in various places, and most of them have now converted to a digital format, so that means there's just a lot more storage. Any sense of that, or is that like not even a thing that is? I mean, I assume there's not an infinite amount of storage space on the ship for data, but I'm just curious if you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't know what our daily generation rate is off the top of my head. I don't know, honestly. It's not so much that it's filling up our network, though, our primary networks. Or even, you know, so we've got tiered networks and different levels of classification and stuff like that, but it doesn't appear to be an issue. That it's not an issue that I manage by any means.
Sure. And of the 20 different departments that kind of make up the ship, do you have a sense for which one is generating the most data on a regular basis? Who's dropping the most data on you?
They probably have an independent network. So for shock trials, for example, I would say our media department, because we had photographers and videographers on the ship, as well as on other ships, as well as on helicopters. And thankfully, they've got a standalone and backed up network for all of the media production stuff, so that it doesn't get in, you know, intermixed with all the other, you know, rudimentary ship stuff. So they probably would dominate during that period of time. And then besides that, probably the engineering and the reactor departments, you know, having to do with propulsion plant.
Yeah, which is interesting. We didn't even talk about the propulsion, but basically, and we're not going to talk about it.
We're not going to talk about it.
Because it's pretty cool. All right, moving on. Tim would like to know to what extent pie charts get used in the data that you review and, on a day-in, day-out basis. Do you see much in the way of pie charts?
Like exploding pie charts? Like
yeah. Like 3D exploding pie charts?
Yeah. Only when they have meaningless slivers.
Okay.
Then we try to use them as much as possible.
That's... I like this guy.
Are you a pie chart guy, Tim? Or do you hate pie charts?
Oh, he's so anti. That's why he's the quintessential analyst.
Yeah. No, because the neuroscience backs up their highly ineffective way in general to display data. But
really,
we live in different worlds.
Okay, it's that time of the show that is the mysterious quiz, the Conductrix quiz. We should come up with a theme song. Da 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 da. Conductrix quiz. All right. Let me tell you a little bit about Conductrix. They're the company that doesn't promise you a silver bullet to make experimentation easy. They tell you the truth about what it takes to run an effective experimentation program, and then they give you the technology and tools to make that happen. It's a combination of commitment and technology that has served their customers well for over a decade in some of the largest companies with tons of sophisticated data, offering best-in-class technology for testing, contextual bandits, predictive targeting. They always go above and beyond, not only to write crazy test questions for our two co-hosts, but also to go above and beyond and beat client expectations. So check them out. And here we go into the quiz. Mo and Tim, are you ready to hear who you are competing on behalf of?
Absolutely.
Our contestants today, longtime friend of the show, Mike Hermanos. Mo, that is who you are representing.
Poor Mike.
Go, Mo. No, come on. He's got probably, as data has shown, at this point, he's got about a 50% chance. And then, Tim, you are representing Riesling Meyer, who actually was here in Georgia near me. So
Atlanta-based.
Yeah. No favoritism in this selection at all, but we're excited. So, okay, let's get to the test, the quiz.
The test. That's quiz. Exactly what it is. A stupidity test.
That's right.
The torture, the humiliation.
Let's do the painful part. Okay. There's, of course, a big ramp up here. So let me get you started understanding. Let me set the scene. The time, the 1940s. There was the Second World War. Alan Turing led a team at Britain's Bletchley Park that cracked the Enigma machine, a German enciphering device thought by the Germans to generate unbreakable codes. As part of their efforts, Turing and the team created a sort of anti-Enigma machine called the Bomb, to help them decode Enigma messages. Other members of the team at Bletchley went on to create Colossus, the world's first programmable digital computer. And that's where Number Wang came from eventually. No, I'm just kidding. That was a joke from a few episodes ago with Sir Tim Harford. Okay, that Turing was such an important contributor, it's not surprising, given that before the word Turing invented what is known as the Universal Turing Machine, a computing abstraction that is the foundation of modern computer science. Interestingly, Turing didn't develop his universal computing machine in order to build computers. Instead, he was trying to solve one of many problems in mathematics that David Hilbert had proposed. Which of Hilbert's problems was Turing trying to solve using his universal computing machine? Was it A, the continuum hypothesis, or B, proof that the axioms of arithmetic are consistent, C, the Riemann hypothesis, or Riemann hypothesis, D, is there a general process for determining whether a given formula A of the functional calculus is provable, or E, to derive an axiomatic treatment of probability with limit theorems for the foundation of statistical physics?
Do you know, you started with Enigma machine and I was like, I got this. This is in my wheelhouse. And we went to deep right field out of any realm of me possibly knowing the answer.
So, we could go the route of you can choose to select a correct answer or choose an answer that you think is definitely wrong.
Yes.
And to stay alive and alternate that way.
Well, I mean, however you choose to conduct yourselves, I may or may not be able to participate. We'll give it the old Turing test or something. Mo, that doesn't really apply.
I think Matt actually requested that you go first, but...
Stop it. No, he didn't. You're winding me up.
I have a Slack message to prove it, but that's fine.
Okay, we need a brief recap at the answers again, or the options again.
Okay, A, continuum hypothesis. B, proof that the axioms of arithmetic are consistent. C, I'm just going to say the Riemann hypothesis, even though I don't know if that's the right. It's R-I-E-M-A-N-N. D, is there a general process for determining whether a given formula A of the functional calculus is provable, or E, to derive an axiomatic treatment of probability with limit theorems for the foundation of statistical physics?
I'm going to start by saying I think it's not the Riemann hypothesis. I've heard of that and know it, and I'm going to just say it's not that.
Okay.
And so I stay alive if...
So you're saying your answer is this one's not the answer.
Yep.
Okay.
Mo, doesn't mean I win. It just means I don't lose.
Do you want to guess, Mo?
Guess a not answer.
Either way, you can guess a not answer.
I'm going to guess a not answer because that increases my likelihood of getting it right. It's a totally random guess. Completely random. Of not being E.
Of not being E. Okay, so we think we're going to try to eliminate the Riemann hypothesis and eliminate E to derive an axiomatic treatment of probability limit theorems to the foundation of statistical physics. Okay, so let's just sweep those to the side. Amazingly enough, we're able to just sort of blup, those are gone, and now we have three answers. The continuing hypothesis, the proof that axioms of arithmetic are consistent, or D, is there a general process for determining whether a given formula A of the functional calculus is provable.
Okay, so I'm going to end it, which means either I'm going to win or Mo's going to win, because I think it is D.
You think it is D, Mo?
She doesn't have to say if I'm right, then I win, and if I'm wrong, she wins. And we still haven't gotten to the right answer.
Yes. Let's just go.
Yeah, there's two other options. So you're basically, what you're saying, Tim, is you're willing to go double or nothing.
Pretty much.
So if D is not the correct answer, you are going to basically give the win to Mo by default. And she doesn't even have to guess between A or B.
Then you're just going to tell us the answer.
Okay. Yep. And here we go. Boop, 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 boop. Trying to give 1950s computer. And the answer is D. So, Tim, you do win. So congratulations, Riesling. You are a winner. And great job.
That was way back in the... I had circled it. That was a book on the history of Bayesian stuff. I think there was some glimmer of a recognition that was what he was trying to do.
And also a shout out to Joan Clark, who was the amazing woman codebreaker who worked alongside Turing.
Thank you, thank you. Absolutely.
See, that's where I thought this was going.
It should have gone there. All right. Well, thanks for participating, both contestants and Mo and Tim, in this trial by question and the conductrix quiz. And if you want to learn more about conductrix, do go check them out at conductrix.com. You can learn about their products and features on their website. All right. Let's get back to the show.
So, Paul, for the young data analyst enthusiast, what types of roles on the ship, I suppose, are really focused on sort of data analysis? Like, what are the careers that would be available to them? See, I'm always helping out with recruitment, whether it's for Canva or the Navy.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think... So more and more of our systems on Gerald R. Ford are actually digital, so that some of our, we call job specialties ratings in the U.S. Navy. And so some of the ratings that typically would not really touch data at all now do a lot. So the folks that run the aircraft launch system, for example, they can see health data real time as well as logged. And that's an aviation bosun mate equipment. person. I think for this world we're in, where we're concerned about public health and COVID, a lot of our hospital corpsmen actually see data on a daily basis. I don't know how analytical, how much numbers based it is, but it's a whole lot of data that's important. So the happy place answer for that would be our information technology folks that run our networks and maintain our networks and make sure that our networks are healthy are likely in that category. And then we've got network folks embedded in different areas of the engineering aspect of what the ship does to make sure the networks that run those systems are healthy too. So I think those are probably the big ones that come to mind. And actually what's really interesting is, I'm sorry to pile on, but the some of the ratings, and I, in the same way that I mentioned with the aviation bosun mate rating, the machinist mates, for example, will be touching data systems now, whereas they used to only touch pumps and machinery, because some of those valves and things that they're touching are actually controlled by via a network, or they're networked and have fiber optics that enable communications and stuff like that. So it's really pretty cool, because the sailors that come in the door are naturally a lot more tech savvy than a generation or two ago. And so we find people who gravitate to that kind of work as like almost an adjunct or collateral portion of what they're doing. And it's like a nice fit. It's a good, you know, one of the aspects of having a good job satisfaction sense is when you have mastery of the thing you're doing, but also when you've got purpose and when you've got some autonomy that you've chosen that, and it's not just being foisted on you. So that's a good thing in my mind.
Awesome. Okay, we have got to start to wrap up, but this is all kinds of amazing childhood dreams come true for me. So thank you so much for being on the show, first and foremost. Paul, it's been delightful to chat with you.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. And it's been fun to be with y'all.
Okay, so one thing we do like to do is go around the horn and share something that might be of interest to our listeners, or something you found interesting lately. So we'll do that. It's our last call. And Paul, you're our guest. Do you have a last call you'd like to share?
Sure. Yeah. So I've got a bit of a commute that takes up time for me in the morning. And I think listening to podcasts is something that I do, as well as listening to audiobooks. So one of my favorites is No Stupid Questions. I don't know if you've heard of that podcast with Angie Duckworth and Stephen Dubner, but it's a good one. It's enjoyable. It's light enough, but there's some topics that they touch on that sometimes get me interested in other things. And I'm listening to a book that's from a long time ago. It's John Steinbeck, and it's called The Log from the Sea of Cortez. And I really enjoy his style of writing, and this is it's a fun one to listen to. It's from, I think it was published in 1951, but the experience is based on something he did in the early 40s.
Nice.
Wow.
That makes me reevaluate my last call. So good job. No, I'm just kidding. Mo, what about you? What's your last call?
Well, I've had this book sitting there for a fair while, and I kind of kept putting it off. I don't know why. Maybe it's because I was worried it would actually impact my life in a positive way, and I wasn't ready to change. So I didn't. Yeah. So I didn't read it. And it's a book that everyone in tech reads it. And I actually was on a call with a bunch of women who work in tech the other day, and I was like, okay, guys, I'm about to start this book. Has everyone read it? And of course, everyone had. And I was like, okay, tell me one thing that you read in this book that you still do now. And to be fair, everyone kind of like told me the contents of the book, but couldn't list one thing that they still did. So I was a little
This is quite a wind-up to this. Yeah. I feel like this is a quiz.
Okay. Anyway,
it was the Bible.
It was Atomic Habits. And so I've just read it. And I think the reason that I put it off is that I know in myself that I perform at my best when I'm in a really good routine. Like if I get up early every morning, if I exercise, like what I eat for breakfast, all that sort of stuff. Like it's how I get the best out of myself at work every day. And as I'm preparing to go back to work, it's something that I really wanted to nail. So I was like, now is the time. But of course, when I had Harry, I kind of wasn't ready to get back into a good routine yet. And now I am. And I'm actually finding this, Tim, could be a book that I go on about for a long time. Like think like my sleep book that I got obsessed with. This could be the next obsession because I'm already finding I'm going to bed every night and like reading books and like trying to tackle my insomnia and not using my phone at night. Like all these little habits that are making my life better. So
it sounds like you sort of knew how you worked and then this, you kind of verified it. It was kind of like a shock trial of a...
Yeah, whatever you do, if you're doing all this reading and stuff, don't have any more children. Probably just stay right where you are. that's unsolicited advice.
Mo, I'm so glad that you're reading that because I've had that on my list to read almost all year and I've not read it. So as you share tips and tidbits, I'll be glad to pick those up.
Habit stacking.
Well, wait a minute,
habit
Michael. Stacking. I feel like we need to check in then. Have you finished? What's the book called?
Because it is. I didn't finish it and I learned from reading the half of the book I read that it's okay not to. So
I've gone to the bookstore. There is no print on any of the pages after for the back 2/3 of the book because that.
Shout out to John Acuff. All right, Tim, what's your last call?
So one, I just want to throw in one little bit of perspective from the shock trials. I feel like that, like trying to equate that to like if you take a marketer who's doing like a Super Bowl commercial, it's going way out and they're like super nervous. And I feel like the shock trials are a little bit of perspective. It's completely the opposite. It's much higher stakes, but actually much more of a known or expected outcome. Whereas you do some crazy marketing thing, as much as we'd like to think the stakes are really high, you know, there aren't human beings and safety involved, but there are a lot more unknowns because marketers are just shooting from the hip a lot more. But not my last call. My last call is going to be because we said we weren't going to talk about like specific systems, but I did, even Paul said this was pretty cool. So I just encourage people to go look up the Plasma Arc Waste Destruction System and watch some of the videos. So
yes. I second that.
Is the Ford class, is that the first class of ships that have had that system?
Absolutely. Yeah, it uses. I think it uses a bit of power. It helps to have a couple of reactors on your side if you got a plasma arc waste destruction system. But it does eat trash like nobody's business. It's awesome. I mean, it. I've never seen shorter lines for trash processing. It doesn't sound like a super sexy or awesome thing to have on a warship, but gosh, if you've got trash stacking up, life is not a good life. But if you've got the trash going away in a very environmentally appropriate way, where you know that we take hundreds of pounds of trash, it ends up in a basically a very light slurry of ash by the time it's done, and it's not at all impacting the environment. I'm pretty excited about that.
Pretty incredible.
Sorry.
Yeah. No.
Pod.
No, we didn't get to it. I'm like, I'll just make it my last call.
That's right.
Nice. What's yours, Michael?
Well, I recently found out through the great newsletter that Ken Williams does that Google has come out with a new sample data set for Google Analytics 4 and BigQuery. So it was pretty timely. I was chatting with someone who was looking for a way to learn some things about BigQuery and some SQL. And I was like, oh, well, actually, here's these sample e-commerce data that you can actually use in their sandbox. And it comes with some queries and things like that to get you started. So that's...
Was that Ken's newsletter or Simo's newsletter?
Well, it's probably both. Maybe both. I think I saw it on Twitter first, but then I remembered it from Ken's newsletter. But, you know, I want to give Ken a shout out. Simo's already pretty famous. So, you know... Much love, Simo. Then the other one is a little off topic, but I think I've run into this fairly recently, and I think a lot of people do because I've seen it come up again and again, which is I don't cook every day, but sometimes I try to get in the kitchen and help out, and sometimes I go in there to cook something and I need to pull up a recipe, and the internet is full of these recipe websites that just simply will do everything but show you the recipe. And when you're on your phone and you're kind of feeling a little bit of time pressure, it's one of the most frustrating things in the world. And I ran across a website called Just the Fucking Recipe. And it's not super big yet in terms of how many recipes they have, but it is sent from above. It's amazing and deserves a shout out. I am so happy.
All for this.
Yes, I know. So it's so random, but it's one of those things. It's just like, that's a quality of life improvement.
That is.
You know, so I'm like, now I'm looking for recipes on this website that I can cook
because I'm like so excited about the fact that it's literally just the recipe. And anyways, that's my
dude. I had one the other day that was to make brown rice, and it had a one-page introduction to make brown rice. Like,
yeah.
We can go a little off topic.
Okay, we've gone really off topic today, but that's all right.
All right. That's excellent. We know you've been listening. You may have questions. Honestly, we don't know if we can answer your questions, but we do want to hear your comments and love to hear from you about the show. So please feel free to reach out to us. You can do that on the Measure Slack group. You can also reach out to us on our Twitter handle and obviously on our LinkedIn group. And you know, we'd love to hear from you and any comments you have. It's just a really cool show. And this is part of the reason we changed it from being just digital analytics to be more broadly analytics, so we could do cool stuff like this.
You can also reach out to Paul, and you will get routed to the media relations department the USS Gerald R. Ford, an impressive operation. I'm not saying that just because they will be reviewing this before. They were very, very helpful, and we do appreciate them. But it was amusing also.
That is technically where we learned about the plasma arc waste destruction system. All right. Well, no show would be complete without mentioning the amazing work done behind the scenes by Josh Crowhurst, our producer. Does an incredible job getting this show out the door every time we make an episode. And I also want to give a special shout out to Megan Singh, who has listened to every single episode of the podcast, which seems like it's sort of a punishment. So, like, Megan, I don't know how you did that, but wow, amazing job. We'd send you a prize, but we don't want to encourage others in this way. So just a shout out for listening to every episode. Thank you so much for being a listener. All right. Well, once again, Captain Lanzalotta, Paul, Polly, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Sir.
You know, it's not a Friday.
Thank you, sir.
It's been a real privilege. Thank you for helping us understand a little more about what goes on in the USS Gerald R. Ford and the amazing men and women and people who serve on that ship with you and doing such an amazing job. We're very much in your debt. So I know that even though you may not serve on an aircraft carrier of this scale, you still have incredible things that you need to do with your job. And I know I speak for both of my co-hosts, Mo and Tim, when I tell you, whether you're launching 10 and recovering 13 or just looking at the latest marketing channels, keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening. Let's keep the conversation going with your comments, suggestions, and questions on Twitter at Analytics Hour, on the web at analyticshour.io, our LinkedIn group, and the Measure Chat Slack group. Music for the podcast by Josh Crowhurst.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
Analytics. Oh my God. What the fuck does that even mean?
Just give me 2 seconds because Jamie's going to come grab the little human.
Okay. Tell him he can just walk in. It's not a big deal.
Mo's husband he tries to sneak in, yet does such a terrible job. We're not sure if he understands how light works. I'm not at home, so.
Oh, well, I forgot. Where are you, Tim?
Cleveland.
That's not that exciting.
Gateway to the, I don't know what.
Flats in Cleveland. Yeah.
Gateway to the Lake Erie, anyways.
That's kind of Michael's hometown.
I grew up in Cleveland, but I moved away as an adult and realized that was a great choice. We do maintain an explicit rating on iTunes and other podcasting platforms, so feel free to use any terminology you see fit.
You could, like, curse like a sailor. Pretty much say anything.
I'd like to, but I probably won't.
I was going to say it's...
There's decorum. Rock flag, and it's a ship, damn it! Okay. There's a... At the very end of our outtakes, there's a It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia reference, and they refuse to let me warn guests that I'm going to have to do something.
I don't refuse. So. You delight in not letting people know.
No.
No. Oh, I start panicking
about
2 minutes before I realize I'm going to have to do it.
Oh, okay.
But
traditions.